So, Wayne gave me this topic. I'm sure not sure why, but he did. So what I'm going to talk to you today a little bit about is fiber crop production practices with climate change, changing climate. Most of my comments will be about cotton. We did do a little work with flax grown for linen. So I have a couple slides with some comments about that. I'm not going to give you a long introduction about climate change. There's a lot out there. One thing I'm pretty sure that's not going to happen, though, let's see, is we probably won't have any Sharknadoes. Unfortunately, I'd love to see one. But obviously, it's going to get warmer. All the climate change models, depending on where you are, it's going to get warmer. And precipitation is going to change. Some regions are going to get more, some regions less. So it's kind of hard to generalize. In the southeast U.S., our precipitation is actually supposed to be a little bit more, a few more millimeters per year. But that precipitation is expected to be from fewer but more intense storms. So during the same year, we're going to have periods of drought stress, and as we had in early November, we're going to have periods of more rainfall. And so this is important not only in the growing season, but I'm very concerned about all the rain like we had this year during the harvest season. Just a little bit of rain changes the cotton somewhat, but this is what it looked like in my plots. And I thought this was 2.5 to 3 bale cotton before we got that 20 inches in. And then we got 20 inches of rain, and that's what they looked like shortly after. So I'm not sure what we're going to get out of that. So looking through the literature, the projected production changes that we're expecting are varieties and species with increased resistance to heat, drought, and flooding. People have been saying that we're going to be changing the timing or the location of cropping activities. Obviously, if we're going to increase temperatures, and change precipitation, we're going to need improved soil water management methods, including irrigation, and just improved soil management. Okay. So I'm not going to say very much on breeding, just a couple of things that we're doing at our lab, Todd, primarily with this, but because there's already considerable effort being done to develop lines tolerant to heat and drought. At our lab, with Cotton Incorporated support, we've put in a high-throughput phenotyping system, and we put it together, and we're really going to put it to work next year. But we're blending that with the molecular, and this was a very interesting study where we studied cotton roots and found 1,530 genes were being differentially expressed in the cotton field. These are not potted plants. In plants next to each other, either at minus 2.6 bars megapascals or leaf water potentials of 1.5. Quite a lot going on in plants that are drought stressed and not drought stressed. Okay, planting patterns are going to change, and this is some work Bill Pettigrew did quite a while ago, and I think he's still working on it. But his early planting system, and this is one instance where climate change might help that growing region, and that what Bill found with very early planting. He was able to move flowering time earlier in the season and line up the crop with more bolls being developed during the longest days of the year, the most daylight times of the year. And he's published several papers even since this one, but he's found by doing this, he's finding yield increases. And so this, you know, this is actually might be a good thing, especially for that region and other regions that can benefit from it. Okay, here's a paper I found in the literature, and this is quite interesting. This is soybean wheat double cropping, but it's a modeling study where they combine the phenology models with the climate change models. And this graph here is just the probability of survival of the soybeans following wheat. And you can see, and this is graphs down here are if CO2 doesn't increase anymore after 2045. So you can see, obviously, the line where we can double crop soybeans and wheat going up across the eastern United States with increasing temperature in 2020 to 2040 compared to what we have right now. The blue is probability of survival is 1 and green is 0. And you see it moving up. What was really interesting about this was they did some sensitivity analysis, and they suggested that the expanded land area was due much more to increasing average temperature and driving plant growth and phenology faster, and not necessarily due to changes in when the fall freeze occurs. Okay, we've had some recent commercial experience working with flax and double cropping with soybeans and cotton. And in our region, this company went out of business in the region, partly because the timing for trying to get the flax out, get it cut, get it dew-redded, get it harvested, was not really in time to get the cotton planted and get a decent crop after that. As temperatures increase, systems like this trying to get more fiber crops in here in the production systems might become much more viable. And then these are just some different varieties of flax we were growing for them to look at while they were there. Okay, but I think double cropping is going to be more important as we go on. Obviously, we got climate change, but we also have population change, and as this increases to 9 billion by the early 2040s, we're going to need more food. And here's a graph from Nature showing the allocation of cropland to food crops and to crops of other uses. This is back in 2000. The blue is on the map are areas where a very low proportion of the land area is being grown for food. A lot of that's feed that's going to feed animals that we then eat. But and then the red, that's the land areas in the world that the land is being used to grow food crops. And obviously our cotton areas are non-food areas. So what we need to do is find ways, I think, to double crop more or get food crops into our rotation. Okay, climate change with increased evapotranspiration demands. We're going to have to improve irrigation and drainage for the big floods and the more water time. We're going to get better with irrigation. Obviously, this is not a valley image. I didn't get that deleted off when I made this slide. But we're going to do more drip. We're going to do more precision irrigation, the valley systems that are out now. We're going to get better at using those so we can do site-specific irrigation. This is just an NDVI image of a field, a irrigated cotton field in South Carolina, showing the areas, even though this was well irrigated, we have big differences. And we can put less water where there's less vegetation since it won't evaporate off and save a bunch of water and just do a better job of watering. And irrigation is going to get better because we're going to have to monitor the crop make more use of tools like soil water sensors and canopy temperature sensors to be more precise in how we use water. One thing kind of aside from climate change, but it might tend to exacerbate climate change, is this move to bigger equipment. These small cotton harvesters that we're used to that hold two or three or four bales of cotton, they weren't all that heavy. But a recent review by a group out of Australia showed the impact that these big cotton harvesters have on soil compaction. And soil compaction, of course, causes plant water stress because the roots can't get around as well. And so this might actually exacerbate climate change and the drought stress. Now, I don't know many plant breeders other than maybe Wayne who can afford a $650,000 picker in their program. But this is one thing we're looking for lines more compaction resistant might be an important thing to look at, especially if growers are going to more and more of these big pickers. And we've got a little evidence from our lab, this is old data now, showing that there's some differences in germplasm genetic diversity for ability to root through compacted soils. This was by experiment done by a plant physiologist at our lab and a soil physicist where they set up a system where they grew roots down to a compacted layer and then just measured the roots that got below that compacted layer. And this is just a picture of our soil. This is our notorious hard pan layer that we have to disrupt every year. But these areas here, this is beach sand with a little bit of organic matter in it. This also gets packed very tightly. But what Caspar Bauer and Buescher found was that a released cultivar, PD1, was able to penetrate better a compacted layer in the soil, much better than PD695, I believe, which was a line that just didn't yield as good as PD1. And so selection in our germplasm, when Todd's making selections for yield, we probably are already making some selections for better root growth in compacted soils. One thing kind of driving it's not driving the soils bus, but what's very important now in NRCS in the United States is this move towards soil health and changing our cropping systems to match better protect both the environment and make soils more climate resilient. And this is a very interesting paper. It's in the Journal of Soil Water Conservation. I think it came out in July this year by Ratan Lal. He kind of outlined how he thinks we're going from no-till planting, which we're doing now, up to going from conservation tillage to conservation agriculture. And this is just simple no-till planting into a corn stubble mulch down here at the bottom, including the mulch, and then we're going into cover cropping. As you can see, planting into a cover crop here. Then going into complex crop rotations. Finally adding in integrated nutrient management to protect the waters, save nutrients because they're very expensive. Especially phosphorus and potassium now, to get to a more conservation agriculture thinking rather than simply no-till or conservation tillage. And just stepping back, going back down to the bottom, we know the soil water balance, and we know a conservation tillage with some residues on the surface do much better job of getting water into the soil than conventional tillage. And the guys out in West Texas showed quite a while now the importance of keeping the soil surface residues covered with evaporation, keeping it covered to reduce evaporation and increase transpiration, put the water through the plants that's there. And this is just some data from one of my studies that illustrated that pretty nicely, so I put my graph up showing the yield increases with conservation tillage during the no-till, during the drought years that we had, a five-year drought, the year before the drought, no real difference between the two tillage systems. And we're going to have to find a way to at least maintain organic matter in the soils, if not increase it, as temperatures rise. This is a very old graph, but from 1938, Soils and Men, where they sampled native soils along French lines and the like for total nitrogen content in the soil. This can be equated with soil organic matter. And as you can see in the graph, it goes down very nicely as average mean annual temperature increases, going from Canada down to Louisiana. So we boost temperatures a little bit. We're going to have to find ways to increase organic matter, or at least maintain our organic matter. Organic matter is very important for soil water. We all know this, but I need to be reminded of it more often. Organic matter in the soil, as you increase organic matter, you increase the permanent wilting point of that soil, but you also increase field capacity. And this one's a sand, and this one's a silt. And the difference between these two is plant available water. So you actually increase plant available water as we're increasing soil organic matter in both of these soils. And so I think this will be a key to trying to build organic matter in our soils to handle some of these drought periods. Whether we get more rain or not, we're going to have more drought periods. And this is going to be particularly difficult for flax production, of course, and any bast fiber. With flax, you have to take off all the biomass. With cotton, at least we have some leaves and some stalks left. And in Europe, they actually pull the fiber, the plants, because some of the fiber goes down below the soil line a little bit, so they can get more higher fiber yields. But this is going to be a challenge to get that in the cropping systems for bass crops to get higher soil organic matter. Also with flax, what we found was it's pretty important at planting to keep the land free from debris, especially old cotton bolls and things like that, no tilling, because you don't want cotton bolls mixed in with here and go through flax processing, cotton fibers rather. Okay, one thing about our soils, as we move into more soil health, we need to know more about the microbes. 8 years of no-till, this is in North Alabama. This is a paper out of the Auburn group, showed big differences in soil microbial biomass near the surface. When you compared conventional and no-till, and that's just the PFLA data. Are these microbes doing anything? We need to know what they are and what they're doing in there. We've got some data in some plots where we've grown no-till or conventional since 1978, showing a very distinct population in the soil around the roots. of conventional tillage cotton. These times are just different weeks after emergence. The P is pre-plant. But you can see this is some data Tom Ducey collected out of those plots, showing a very distinct microbial communities. And here's some preliminary data that we've got. But in these plots, I didn't have a picture of cotton that showed it as good as this corn. So here's the dividing line between the conventional tillage and the conservation tillage. We went in and we took some roots of some cotton plants right about in here, and took some roots from right about in here, and we did this in two reps through the field. There's five reps in this field. But just from here to here, and we didn't really experience any drought stress before we started, we took these samples, but we found gene differentiation of over 1,000 genes just between these two tillage systems. So selection under no-till, in the past, you know, conventional varieties always did better, just as fine in no-till and conventional, but we might actually be able to select under conservation tillage and make faster progress or better progress. Okay, and I'm going to end up just with an example of what I think is a really cool idea that's already almost here at conservation agriculture for a particular ecosystem for cotton production, and that's David Wright's sod-based peanut cotton rotation. Typically in Florida, peanuts are a big money maker. Cotton's in the rotation, but you got to go out of peanuts for a couple of years for diseases and the like. And so the conventional rotation is peanuts followed by a winter cover of oats, followed by 2 years of cotton with cover crops in between. And all this is planted with no-till or conservation tillage. His sod-based system incorporates cattle or hay production. And basically he has 2 years of bahia grass with a rye grass or an oat rye winter cover crop, grazing or haying the bahia, followed by peanuts, and then followed by cotton again with the cover crops. And what he's showing is some dramatic differences in this cropping system. We talk about with no-till being able to increase conservation tillage 0.1% per year in the top few centimeters of the soil. Well, with this system, David's finding it in the top foot of the soil, which was kind of amazing. He's increasing it 0.1% per year in the top foot with this system. And primarily that's because of the bahia grass. You get 20,000 kilograms per hectare of root mass compared to our annual crops and even the winter cover crops. They're not rooters like the perennial grasses. And so we can't build no soil organic matter near as fast. And these are just some of the things he's finding. Again, he's increasing soil organic matter 0.1% per year. But he's finding improved soil tilth. He's getting deeper water infiltration, partly because he's got a whole bunch of earthworms out there digging holes, partly because the higher soil organic matter and then the root channels from that bahia grass. He's found they're reducing their irrigation needs by 50% to 70%, partly because of bahia grass they don't have to irrigate near as much because it's a perennial, it'll survive, and you're using it for hay. He's also finding reduced pesticide use. Obviously, if you've got 2 years of bahia grass, you're not spraying cotton or peanuts. Reduced N and K in the entire system, and they're finding enhanced indicator enzymes for carbon, nitrogen, phosphorus, and sulfur cycling. But very interesting on farm management and returns, they're having much reduced risk from weather in this system. basically because he's got 2 years of bahia grass in the entire system, and you know, you got half your crop in peanuts and cotton, and half of it in bahia grass, and so you worry about the half with the peanuts and cotton. But he's suggesting he can increase farm profits 2 to 7-fold with this system in their region. And with that, I'll finish.
Thanks, Bill. Couple questions, Bill. So, as we're looking at resilient systems for climate change, a whole lot of what you showed is sort of tools and technologies that we currently know, but simply figuring out how to apply them maybe differently in a different system or a different region. Is that going to be the answer, that we basically know the general agronomy of all these systems? We may just be growing it in Alabama more like we grew it in Florida before the climate change, or just shifting things around, or are we going to have to come up with whole new understandings of stuff?
Well, I think whole new understandings will change all this. But I don't know what those whole new understandings are. But we did a whole new understanding of some genes to put in the plant, and all this might not change. But I think we will be going more with soil health, simply because we can't keep polluting the oceans and the rivers, and we can't have all our topsoil wash away, because then it doesn't matter what you put into the soil or into the plants, you're not going to grow them. So I think that part is actually going to have to change if we're going to maintain agriculture.
Bill, I was intrigued by your graph of the increased potential for double cropping further north as climate changes. Mm-hmm. How much are the soils that are good at, how much are the Iowan soils going to deteriorate when we get warmer temperatures up there? Are we looking at some major problems with the, as those areas get warmer from a soil health, soil quality standpoint?
Well, probably. I mean, as temperatures increase, we're going to lose organic matter. I'm not an expert in the Midwest. Our cropping system is all again too tight. I mean, there's going to be a lot of people talking about it. But yeah, I mean, that's why we're looking hard at cover crops right now. Trying to maintain and increase the size.
Okay, let's thank our speakers one more time. And short business meeting. We want to keep this community going. We want to maintain try to have a Todd and other fibers present. Any suggestions of how we expand the group? We don't need an election because you know Todd Campbell is already Eric after that. So we're open to suggestions.
What meeting next year?
Today, a lot of the cotton, maybe next time we need to get at least one.
We've reached out to the hemp folks. Who else is on cotton? He has one cotton. So, Vicky is about this, so we don't even have a non cotton person. But, we have made an effort to do that. Perhaps, Todd and Eric and the rest of you would do a better job than I did at that. But we have reached out.
But in another way, if this is a very exclusive community like today as a cotton, we can make one as a cotton of pesticide, because the common people usually, I'm asking very weak for this meeting.
And this was Eric's leadership trying to establish this and see if we couldn't have a nucleus, a place for Cotton's presence at the Tribal Society meeting.
Yeah, Toby Fitzsimmons, University of Arkansas. One of the big things I find that we see at this timing, so to speak, is one of our research is actually just being in or being analyzed, and then we're forced to say, hey, let's go ahead and make a poster presentation. A lot of these poster presentations are on theoreticals and hopeful, wishful thinking. So we wait and postpone to go into the belt line when we can really, really shine. So maybe there's something that we should really take a look and consider in that regard. Is the timing and the research for a lot of the, professors and graduate students and whatnot, and having that tie into the drive that we have right now.
Well, I agree, and I think it certainly has an impact, because I just can't get out of the field more places and get that analyzed, even if you're not at the faculty for the current year, just get other kind of stuff analyzed for early to mid November. I don't have any good ideas for a way around that, but hopefully that, at least in my view of the world, ideally there would be graduate students and others presenting multiple year data. Even if you don't have that lab here, you still have the first year and partial second or third or whatever.
So just to stay, one of these kids, whenever we have, say we make a presentation, say a Beltline, are you suggesting that we go ahead and repeat that presentation again for here? Because we have to consider that, we have the Beltline come on, and then we spend a good chunk of time go ahead and planning and presenting, and then we turn around and have to do it again. So talking about several year data, we're looking at grad students and whatnot who may only be here 2 years, and then you're looking at 1 year data presentation. A lot of them are probably going to be along the lines of maybe modeling or maybe one growth chamber experiment or something along those lines. Are we okay with that?
You guys tell us. I personally am okay with that.
Okay. And that's what I did. Right?
That's what I did.
You have the data that was presented at the Beltline,
And hopefully you get to add a little bit of data too.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah. If you don't, though, it's still new for this meeting.
What is important is here everybody is together.
Yes.
At the Beltoir, I talk about public quality to the guys that talk about public quality.
Yeah.
It's not that exciting, I can tell you that. here, you can have all the disciplines sharing ideas. Mm-hmm. And I think it could bring new things.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree with that.
Okay.
I'd just like to respond to what Eric and Toby have said, because I think you have a unique opportunity here to not focus on the most recent year's data, but look at the bigger pictures. We have three great presentations that I don't think I saw a little bit of anything that said 2015 on it, but yet they had a great opportunity to look back and help us look forward, and that's a unique opportunity for this meeting here.
You like the quarter day, or do you think we should ask for longer half-day session instead of a quarter-day session? Or do you think this was a nice size, a symposium type that you get in and get some overviews and
depends,
move on to something else?
Depending, if it's only for Cotton, it's not be fine, but if you put in Cotton and other fiber crops, when the other fiber crops come in, the quarter may not be enough.
My God, and I think that's going to be I don't have a feel for how many essentially public scientists there are in other fibers. I just don't have a sense for that. I know the Kentucky group is doing some hemp work, and I assume some others are. Phil talked about sesame. I don't know, but certainly if it grows, it grows. And it may well be that if we stay with the quarter day session, if that's what the practice scientists give us, that it could be next year, it could be all other fibers or
one cotton and two other fibers, and I've tried to mix them in. I mean, this year was by invitation. We put together a list of people that we thought would be an interesting presentation that everyone would be interested in, and went out and invited those folks. And pleasant surprise, they all said yes. The first group. It always makes life easy.
But one of the reasons why we selected Sunday afternoon was because the week is so busy as it is. And we felt that there would be fewer conflicts with other employees and COVID and so forth. It turns out there's still conflicts today that are going to be unavoidable.
It's hard to get time at this meeting for stand-up presentations.
Well, one thing is that this community is only about 6 months old.
Right.
So we didn't have a full year to go out and recruit other fiber folks.
Right.
So you did a full court press.
We reached out to some folks, but again, hopefully, if we stick with it, we'll get some of those other folks to come in, even though the first word in time is cotton.
Yes, would there be opportunities for graduate student competition within this community?
Sure.
Yes.
Because I think that would, you talk about quarter day, half day, even just within cotton, you bring in graduate students of all these folks, it seems like it could be a pretty sizable meeting and bring in some interest there, I believe.
It could, and I'll have to admit that the poster sessions, they're tied to other sessions such as this, so the posters competition could be a part of the cotton fibers community and a part of the overall competition and presentations on other days. Yes, sir.
I'm just here, I'm a representative of the section.
Uh-huh.
I'm the voted income. I'm covering three of us, trying to cover the 14 different communities in the section. So anything that you have to bring back to the overall section on this would be good. And the posters, from the bioenergy, that's where I was the community leader there. We brought in the poster section here, and that really attracted me.
Anything else?
So we're going to keep it at a quarter?
That's what I heard, that if we could, primarily because we think that's all the time that we will get a lot of. And expand it to posters next time. Again, probably reach out. I would think at a quarter day, if we expanded the poster session with it, that a quarter day would remain symposium packed with invited speakers. Does that sound reasonable? I mean, it's hard to open it up to five speakers. But we certainly could have one of the things that we do in the National Association of Frank Readers is that we folks who submit their posters, we invite them to present stand-up as well. And it could be that in a 2-hour session, we could have 3 25-minute presentations and a couple of 10-minute presentations for those graduate students. I mean, all sorts of organizational ideas and opportunities are on the table. Okay? Thank you for coming. For a while, Jonathan thought we were just going to pull up a couple of chairs and stop.